Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. Is it time to rename the British Broadcasting Corporation the British Bolshevik Corporation? Mired in accusations of bias, we ask if the BBC really is a bastion of left-wing lobbydom, or if the right is just being unduly paranoid. Also, what will we do when all the rockers are dead? We examine the cultural wasteland that is life after Lou Reed. I'm joined in the studio by Telegraph blogger James Dellingpool, the former BBC arts correspondent Rosie Millard, and by the Telegraph features writer Mick Brown. When left-wingers watch the BBC, they see fair and balanced reporting. When conservatives watch the BBC, they see subjectivity and bias. A study conducted by Oliver Latham called Bias at the BBC found that the broadcaster is twice as likely to cover left-wing policy proposals than those that are produced by the right, that it tends to attach a health warning to conservative pundits that it interviews, and that some regular news shows give twice as much coverage to pro-EU opinions than they do to anti-EU opinions. But maybe the right-wing panic about the BBC is all just crazy paranoia. Perhaps, as Harriet Harman recently told Andrew Marr, we on the right are just miffed because the Beeb's objective reporting can't help but show how we're ruining the country. Rosie Millard, are we just being paranoid?
I think it's an agenda proposed by the right-wing press that the BBC is innately left-wing. I was a correspondent at the BBC for 10 years, so I really do have a very good experience of working in the newsroom. And I have to say that in my 10-year experience as a reporter there, I never saw an outwardly left-wing agenda being proposed. What I did see was a very establishment agenda. I mean, the BBC is so riddled with people from Oxbridge that they don't even talk about what university you went to. They talk about what college you went to.
Right.
You know, that is actually the establishment that rules the BBC. And therefore, I think it's a very, very conservative, very unradical of either persuasion. I don't think it's either right wing or left wing. I just think it sort of promotes the status quo.
James.
Well, it's interesting, Rosie, that even in what you just said there, you betrayed an unconscious political viewpoint, which is that I would contend there's absolutely nothing wrong with a BBC run by people who've been to Oxford and Cambridge. Why not have the brightest and best in the country? The idea that the top people at the BBC should come from all different backgrounds in order to represent the country at large, I don't think that is a viewpoint I would agree with.
But it's paid for. By the entire country. The license fee is reflect the license payer. And the trouble is that you can see it in who actually watches the BBC. The BBC is not really watched in the heartlands of what one might call urban left, i.e. the large urban conurbations in the north.
Yes,
and yet
the BBC very much reflects the sensibility of the metropolitan, liberal, chattering classes. I use liberal in the American sense. You said that you worked at the BBC for 10 years and that you never noticed any noticeable left-wing bias. I think that most BBC staffers would say exactly the same thing. And the reason that they would say that is that they are quite incapable of seeing the bias because of their Weltanschauung, the newspapers they read. They read The Guardian. They read The Guardian, as we know, is the most subscribed to newspaper at the BBC. That they're not Daily Mail or even Telegraph readers at the BBC.
So I think James's point is that if you worked at the BBC, you might not notice that the BBC is left-wing.
Yes, but
because you are left-wing.
But what James doesn't know, because he hasn't worked in the BBC newsroom, is that the 6 o'clock news, the agenda, the running order on the 6 o'clock news, and this is known, is entirely prescribed by what is on the front cover of the Daily Mail. Actually,
right.
It is the front cover of the Daily Mail that dictates the news agenda at the BBC, and certainly for the 6 o'clock news. If the Mail is covering it, it's on the front cover, it will be pretty high up, if not the top story.
Well, that's probably because if
that
the Daily
sound to
Mail
me like
is
a left-wing agenda.
No, but if the Daily Mail is covering something that's front page, it's probably a big story.
Yes,
therefore,
of course.
So the issue isn't the fact that they might cover the same story as the Daily Mail. Surely the issue is with how they actually cover the story that the Daily Mail.
You just said they didn't read read the Daily Mail. Well, I'm saying they don't not only read it, they take it as a barometer of what's happening in the nation,
yes,
and reflect it on their own broadcast.
But probably as something that they can react against rather than something whose values they can champion.
And we have a
champion.
Concrete point, example of that. Sorry, James, I will you come in. But when the Sunday Telegraph recently reported on the impact of European migration on the British budget, it was hit by a rebuttal on the BBC 10 o'clock news. They obviously had read the story there. I'll give them credit for that. In which they spent 10 minutes deconstructing the story. They didn't really allow anyone else to defend our position or to defend what we had said. They just simply said that this is untrue and our report was totally fictional. That was a report by the BBC News. Yes, they read our report, but they used it as an opportunity to defend the EU and to disagree with us.
I think the amount of times that Nigel Farage has been on Question Time and other people from UKIP would indicate that the BBC actually bends over backwards to include other arguments in the immigration debate.
But I think
it's been quite late on the scene, I admit that, but I don't think...
That is produced by a private production company.
Are you saying that Question Time is not a programme?
No, but I'm saying if we're talking about cultures, I'm so sorry, James. If we're talking about cultures, the BBC Newsroom is something very different from a private
time.
Company.
No, it's not.
That organises
no, really
Question
isn't.
Time.
Excuse me, but actually, you're wrong there. You know, Question Time has to be gone through and is gone through with a tooth comb by the BBC. David Dimbleby is absolutely the voice of the BBC. The production company, the BBC, has to have a quota of programmes that are produced independently.
Yeah.
It doesn't say, well, these programmes are produced independently, therefore they're going to have a different viewpoint from the BBC. I mean, really.
No, my point is that I agree with you. I don't think Question Time is biased, actually. I think they do genuinely try and take someone from each side. And if it ever appears to have bias, that's usually because the audience sometimes goes nuts. But that's not... My point is that it doesn't function within the culture of the BBC because it's produced outside of it. It's produced by a group called Mentorn,
yes,
who produce a lot of those different programmes. And they come from a different culture because they're a private company. They're not from within the BBC. A BBC newsroom, by contrast, does reflect the very corporate establishment culture which you yourself described as coming entirely from Oxbridge.
It is a very conservative culture. I mean, you know, it does try to get in other voices. It really does its best to you know, we're always encouraged to seek for the other side of the argument when you're representing one side of the argument. I mean, I covered the arts world. And yes, you know, subsidy for arts was absolutely questioned. Free admission to museums and galleries was absolutely questioned. Every time these things turned up, you know, the Opera House, my goodness, I did so many pieces about whether the Opera House is worth it and should the Arts Council be funding it and et cetera, et cetera. These are just... This is a natural job of a journalist to question what is happening, the status quo, but it happened at both sides.
James, well, is the real issue just that the right is sort of in the wrong
because
it's in the wrong?
We hear this. I have absolutely no doubt that the BBC's producers bend over backwards to say they've got Owen Jones representing the shrill left. They want to get somebody like Nigel Farage on or even James Dellingpole on to provide that impression of balance. It's not the impression of balance I'm disputing, it's the underlying reality. It's much more subtle. I think that you could name a range of political issues and you know, before you even hear any BBC programme, what its fundamental position is. If it's on Israel, it's going to be against Israel and for the Palestinians. If it's against if it's about free markets, it's generally going to be against it. It favours government.
Can you give a concrete example of one of those, rather than just...
I'll give you a concrete example in a moment, and sadly, it's going to have to be the environmental issue. But before I get there, the BBC's default position is, why isn't the government doing more about this problem? It is never, why isn't the government getting out of the way, leaving us alone, taking less of our money in taxes? That is never a line that you will get from the BBC, because its cultural assumptions are that the state is good because it's a state-funded organisation, it's because it represents the ideology of the people working for it. The most concrete example I can give, just because there's so much evidence of it, is the BBC's stance on environmentalism.
Right.
And we know this. We know what happened 2 years ago when the BBC's lack of neutrality on this issue was questioned. What did the BBC do? It commissioned a report the BBC Trust commissioned a report by Professor Steve Jones, which concluded that actually, no, the BBC should give even less time than it was already to so-called climate change deniers. Now, this suggests to me that the BBC really doesn't get what is going on in the world. It doesn't really tolerate a range of opinions. It pays lip service to neutrality, but actually, when it comes down to it, it ain't neutral.
Rosie.
Well, I don't. I haven't followed the climate change. I know that the debate about climate change has been going to and forth, and I haven't really followed the minutiae of it. I would just say that I think the BBC, you know, again, I've said it once, I'll say it again. I don't think the BBC enjoys having a radical viewpoint of either left or right. I think it's very careful to keep in the middle. I think also it employs very intelligent, smart people who aren't that interested in making a huge amount of money. They're people who would have probably gone into the city and made a fortune.
Sorry, I'm pulling faces here. The BBC's journalists are protected in a way that journalists elsewhere outside the bubble of the BBC, they are much better paid. If you've seen what's going on in the real world in what was Fleet Street, you realise that BBC journalists are cosseted and pampered in a way that other journalists
yes,
are not.
I think
it's a job, it's
yes,
still a job
James,
for life.
I'm outside the BBC now, and I was within the BBC, so I do know both sides. And you know, the BBC's journalists are not. It is quite safe. There's a very nice pension. You get holiday pay, etc., etc. It's nice. It's great. It's a lovely place to work. But you're not going to make a fortune working there. You're not going to make as much money as you would in the city.
Unless you're lucky enough to be sacked and you get an Uber payoff.
Okay. But Rosie, what is the point you're trying to make about the relationship between pay and ethos?
The point is that I don't think that the journalists who work at the BBC are, they're not driven by sort of the capitalist mantra as perhaps people working in the city might be.
Right.
And I've spoken to lots and lots of people at the city, the BBC, who say, oh yes, all my friends are off in the city making a fortune, but I'm here in the BBC. I think the BBC, you know, attracts a certain creative
person. Left-leaning.
And I think that, well, I think that it's easy to sort of to lump in creativity with being left of centre. I think perhaps you could say that creative people may be liberal, but they're not really. I mean, you know, I was about the only person, reporter at the BBC, whose children go to state schools because I believe in state education. Most other reporters and correspondents at the BBC send their children to private schools.
Right.
Yeah.
Although if you look at the Labour front bench, that's
so
not
just congenital lefties, but hypocrites as well. I mean, this is another problem.
Well, they're not lefties. My point is, they're not lefties.
Well, they absolutely are.
Okay. If it's not about the personalities, then is the issue the fact that the BBC feels it has a commitment to represent certain viewpoints and certain voices, more importantly, certain voices? And those are voices which quite often tend to have a left-wing cause attached to them. For example, the corporation is very committed, rightly so, to representing ethnic minorities, people with a different sexual orientation. And that can sometimes lead to program making, which is at least liberal in its outlook.
I think that the BBC... I think the BBC tries to give a viewpoint. It tries to give access to people who are pay the licence fee. All people, in other words, the entire population. I think it fails in this. Actually, I think it leaves out what one might have once called the working class. I think it leaves out people from the north. I think that it is. Really does try to. This is why Five Live has moved up to Salford, so you can have more people in from outside London.
Mm-hmm.
I think it, generally speaking, I think it tends to fail. Mostly, you hear on the Today programme same old people turning up, who also turn up on the Telegraph. You know, you hear the same commentators all the time.
Yeah.
I don't think it. I don't think it succeeds in bringing in a hugely left-wing liberal thing. I think if it can be accused of being left-wing liberal leaning, that's because it just wants to have an argument against the government, which happens to be right-wing at the moment. So obviously, if you're going to be saying, well, let's question this administration, the Cameron administration, the coalition, you're bound to have someone in who's left-leaning, because that's the nature of debate.
Yeah, James.
I really can see the BBC ever attacking the Cameron government from the right. It's I think you've unconsciously nailed the problem with the BBC, mentioning Salford, for example. You've got these spoilt metropolitan left-leaning public school types running the BBC, treading on eggshells in their desperation to represent the people who are paying their compulsory licence fee. And you get these ludicrous sops to universality by, oh, we're going to relocate up north at enormous expense which is borne by the licence fee payer ultimately. You have BBC staffers being given relocation costs to persuade them up north, where they have to live in a compound because there's constant danger of having their cars nicked and stuff. And I would like to ask, how does the licence fee payer actually benefit from this arrangement? How does the Radio 4 listener really benefit from switching on the radio in the afternoon? And it's always about how tough it was growing up being gay in Ireland in the 1930s, or how difficult it is being an ethnic minority, or blah, blah, blah. There is never a programme that you'd want to hear about, say, from the alternative point of view. It is constantly this appeal to the minorities. It's constantly this appeal to this guilt-ridden version of the world. And it is unfortunately what you're going to get when you get a compulsorily funded broadcast organisation. It cannot respond to the market's need. It's constantly trying to second-guess what the market wants.
OK, Rosie, how would you respond to that?
Well, I listened to Radio 4 the other day and heard a perfectly charming piece by Stephen Fry talking about spelling. I mean, you know, OK, we've had Grayson Perry giving the Reith lectures. I suppose you'd say that absolutely concurs with your idea. Here we have a transvestite potter talking about art. Well, it's the first time an artist
Grayson
has been...
Grayson Perry is really interesting, but he's interesting despite the fact that he's transvestite, but rather than because of it, which would be the BBC's view.
I think that the BBC has to be congratulated in trying to be... across the country in actually devolving its offices and programmes across the country. I've quite often appeared on a show called Sunday Morning Live, which comes from Belfast, and all the panel and the presenter all have flown out to Belfast on Saturday to appear in the programme on Sunday at the cost of the licence payer. Well, that is disgraceful, you may say. I mean, I might also say whenever I've done that programme, I'm there are some pretty serious right-wing commentators as well as left-wing. However, there's the taxi drivers, there's the makeup women who are all local from Belfast.
Yeah.
There's the cameraman, the crew. You know, a huge building which is used and properly staffed. You know, for this program, there are researchers. It's very, very important.
It really
is important, actually, James, that something where the whole nation is paying for benefits the nation as best it can. Someone like Bristol, which is what is wrong with that?
What is wrong with it is that this is supposed to be an independent broadcaster with editorial guidelines saying it's balanced, that it has no politics, and yet what you have just described does sound like
putting the Natural History Department out in Bristol. Is that is a centre of
no, but you've described a philosophy behind it and why it does it.
It's very, very difficult trying to defend the licence fee if your programmes all come from London and only involve London people.
But not if it's cost effective, not if it saves people money.
It is quite cost effective.
It's got to be value for money.
It is quite cost effective putting stuff outside into the regions, because buildings cost less, production costs less, actually, outside.
So the BBC saved money with its move to Salford. You think that was a money saving venture?
No, I don't necessarily think it was a money-safe venture, but I think it's a very good venture, because you listen to Nicky Campbell's morning programme on Five Live, and he says, we are now, we are now going down Piccadilly in Manchester rather than Piccadilly in London, and that's very important for the nation.
Okay. Let's close with one final question. is the issue, Rosie, not that in a modern world in which people can choose so many other different broadcasters to go to, there is sort of no market for this fair and balanced state-provided news broadcaster anymore?
I can't believe you're saying this. Oh, my goodness. There is absolutely a market for it. There's absolutely a need to have a channel which is not funded by advertisers. You know, at the very most, what it does is ensure that the quality is up on all its rivals. You know, would there be an ITV of the status that we have with exposure? Would there be a Channel 4 with dispatches? Would there be, you know, if there wasn't Panorama? Yeah, there wouldn't. These programmes would not exist. The news offering on the other channels would not exist if the BBC wasn't as it is.
James Denningpool, last word.
I don't think anyone would dispute that the BBC is capable of making some very good programmes. But you only have to look across to America to realise that there are models, private sector models, which produce equally good programming. You think of HBO, a subscription channel, which made The Sopranos, which made Band of Brothers. The BBC is a socialist relic from a world that no longer happily exists.
Well, how come the rest of the world absolutely envies us for having the BBC? I'd like to know why.
Well, it's probably because it's got the word British in it. Rosie Millard and James Denningpool, thank you both very much. The death of Lou Reed at the age of 71 causes us to pause and think about the slow disappearance of an entire generation of rockers. Mick Jagger is 70, David Bowie is 66, Paul McCartney is 71, and someday they'll all be gone. These men aren't just singers, but genuine artists, people whose songs and philosophy shape the way we think. There's very little around today that can compete with them for cultural impact, unless you buy the hype and think that One Direction really are the new Beatles. So what made that generation so special when compared with today, and what would the world be like when they're gone? Mick Brown, why was that generation, people like Lou Reed, so important?
I think they were important because they were as a song of Lou Reed's said at the time, I'll Be Your Mirror, you know, that could speak for the whole generation of those musicians, that in a way they were the mirror to the times. And if they're important, it's because they were cultural landmarks for a time that was very important, you know, a time when there were enormous cultural shifts, enormous changes. And music at that time, the musicians and the performers of that time were reflecting those changes and reflecting that enormous cultural shift.
So does that mean that time was just more interesting than now?
Well, personally, I think so, because that's the time that I grew up in.
Right.
So, of course,
right.
One's very wedded to that idea. And I'm sure if I were 24 or 25, then I would think that today is equally as important and equally as arresting. Although maybe not, because one of the things that the artists you've all mentioned, all those artists that you've mentioned, you find is that they continue to attract younger fans, and young people look back on the 60s and the 70s with a kind of nostalgia that there's no nostalgia more poignant, is there, than nostalgia for the time you never actually lived through.
Although that implies again that the 60s were just more interesting than now, if that's when we're all looking back to that rather than reveling in our own culture.
Yeah, I mean, interesting not simply because of the events that were taking place and these great social and cultural upheavals that were taking place, but because I think music was more interesting, you know. It was the foundation stone for popular music today, and so much popular music today is simply glancing over its shoulder rather longingly to popular music of yesterday.
James?
I find myself in total agreement with Mick and at the same time disagreeing with him violently, in as much as I would love to have been around in the 60s. I would love to have gone, well, I mean, to have been old enough to go and see, say Love. I saw Love, by the way, at Glastonbury a few years ago, and they were fantastic. It was like forever changes straight off the record. So I'd like to have been around to see the Birds. I'd like to have been around to see the Velvet Underground. But at the same time, Woodstock. Woodstock is the classic example of the event that one is supposed to wish one had been at, when in reality it would have been a complete waste of time. The sound systems at Woodstock would have been absolute rubbish. It pissed down with rain. It would have been a nightmare. The organisation would have been useless compared to, say, a modern Glastonbury, which has got all the delicious food stalls and the fantastic sound systems in it, and you don't have the stages clashing with one another, the sound stages, they're far enough apart, which you wouldn't have got at Woodstock. And I was lucky enough to be a rock critic for many years, still notionally am. Well, like Mick is, of course. And one of the things about being a rock critic is that you become a bit of a neophiliac, and you can appreciate that the past greats were great. I mean, Led Zeppelin, for me, are the ultimate band. They will never be beaten. But at the same time, when I left university, I just caught on to the birth of dance music, acid house.
Right.
I was hanging outside the WAG in the early days.
The WAG.
A club night called Love at the WAG,
right.
Wearing my red bandana, my smiley T-shirt, and a pair of cycling shorts with a Madonna on them. And I was looking around and thinking, this is much as it must have felt to be a punk. You felt like an outsider. You were rebelling. And I was rebelling. And it never occurred to me that this dance thing would catch on, which it did, to the point where you couldn't even watch a children's TV program 3 years later without a pounding techno track underscoring it.
I want to pick you up on the point about Woodstock. Surely those who were there would say that, no, it wasn't very good. It wasn't as well organized as it would have been today. But that wasn't the point. It was a cultural and political phenomenon. In fact, the very fact that it was a bit rubbish kind of adds to its purity. Whereas today what you have when you go to Glastonbury and everything is this very manufactured and synthesized.
Oh, yeah, the old Glastonbury's got too commercial meme. I can tell you, Glastonbury it's the ley lines that do it, man. It's got nothing to do. Actually, it's much nicer having a cleaner toilet than a smellier toilet. It's just
right.
Fact.
Yeah, but this too is a product of your age. That when you were, if you've been in Woodstock in Sam Yazga's farm, you know, 1969, yeah. At the age of 22 or 23, you wouldn't have cared whether the toilets were smelly or not. And I take your point about the music. I'm sure it was a fantastic musical experience if you were within the first 300 yards of the stage.
Yeah.
Not such a fantastic musical experience if you were a quarter of a mile from the stage, which, of course, most of the people who were there were. And if you look back at the music now, listen to the music now, listen to the soundtrack, a lot of it is very indifferent and a lot of it's very patchy. Mm. But as you say, Tim, the significance of Woodstock was not so much as a musical event as a cultural event. And we can look back now and poo-poo it and be very cynical about it and say, oh, yeah, the Aquarian Age, what came of that? You know, it's easy to have a kind of revisionist reading of the 60s with all the idealism and utopianism of the 60s. But that's not to say that at the time it didn't have authenticity, it didn't have true feeling, that this isn't true, it wasn't a true reflection of people's sensibility and sentiment, you know, and Woodstock as a measure of the temper of the times is peerless.
I like to think that had I been around at the time, I would have had the courage to hate its vileness even at the time. I
suspect you wouldn't.
It's like the people who were at the Paris Evenement. They were ghastly, ghastly half-baked lefties interrupting their own education. I don't think there's anything good about that. I really, frankly, I think Altamont and Woodstock are on the same level of awfulness for me. These are the kind of people I would have hated with their ghastly lefty values. I think I like to think I would have seen through the naivety. And,
but isn't the point?
I like the music.
Values.
I like the music.
If we're discussing
not the politics.
But if we're discussing what's different between then and now, isn't the point that they had the values, and the values in some way were the generator for the music? They were trying to make artistic statements in a way that
I think that's
today,
right. And I don't think they were lefty values. They wouldn't have, the people who were at Woodstock would not have seen themselves as leftists. They would not have seen themselves.
They
would have not seen themselves as being left-wing. They'd have seen themselves as being de facto in opposition to any political ideology or any political system.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it was essentially a libertarian movement. I mean, not libertarian in the way we now understand it as being a faction of the right, but libertarian in the sense of freedom to behave as you wanted to dress as you wanted to. Drugs, of course, is a great catalyst for that. An enormous kind of releasing of all the inhibition and of all the conformity of the 1950s.
Yeah. Which reflected some of the what was going on in the 60s. But then to run with the metaphor of the mirror, which I really like that Mick came up with, James, you wrote a piece for The Telegraph pointing out that what was mirrored in popular culture wasn't just that, but also the squares had a culture too. And just as important was things like Slade and Mudd and glam. And, you know, you mentioned that Chirpy Chirpy Cheep Cheep was a number one for several
absolutely.
Weeks.
I think what I was disputing in the article was the idea that there has ever been a golden age where all the artists were pure and authentic, and that our modern times are a pale imitation. And I took my son to Glastonbury for the first time this year. He's just turned 15. And I know that the pleasure he got from the music was exactly the same as anyone would have got in the 1960s from seeing Joni Mitchell or whatever. We went to see a guy called Tom O'Dell. Uh-huh. Tom O'Dell is, I'm convinced, as good and proficient and musical as, say, Elton John would have been in the early days. I don't believe there has really been a falling off in music. Music is constantly reinventing itself. I was very lucky to have been part of the acid house scene. It would have been great to have been there in the late 60s to be psychedelia. It would have been great to be a punk. I think that music is constantly reinventing itself, and that's good.
But then, actually, you raise a good point there about that. It's very easy to idealise the 60s, and you know, to my mind, there was great music in the 60s. There was also terrible music in the 60s.
Yeah.
And if you look at the average top 20 chart from 1965, 1966, which are golden ages, if you like, for rock music. You're going to find an Engelbert Humperdinck. You're going to find a Clive Dunn. You're going to find Ken Dodd.
Very popular. You know. Yeah.
And in a way, that was one of the interesting things about English music at that time, was its eclecticism and its variety and the fact
so then
that
do you think there has been a change in terms of quality?
Personally, yes. And I think it's because, as I was saying earlier, I think because in a sense the template was built at that point. The template was established. And, you know, if we look at, without wishing to get too train-spotterish about it, you know, if you look at the evolution of rock music, pop music, coming out of the blues, coming out of rhythm and blues, coming into that great golden age of British rock with groups like The Who, The Stones, The Kinks, and so forth, where is there to go after that?
Yeah. You know?
And where you go is you go either into hip-hop or you go into electronica. Indie bands, we can see, you know, Oasis were simply the Beatles Redux. You know, Blur were the Kinks Redux.
I think Mick makes a very, very good point there. I think that is why that period between about 1964 and, say, 1971 was so very exciting, because these artists were taking for the first time the blues, R&B, and inventing rock, proper rock music, which is what Led Zeppelin did. And it can't be done again. It's a bit like the crisis that the novel faced after the 19th century. Where could it go? Well, postmodernism came after that, and then that was almost the death of the novel. So what you get now is writers, I mean, for example, Vikram Seth reinventing the 19th century novel with his Suitable Boy, but it's all been done now. It can't really go anywhere but up its own fundament.
And what happens, to bring us back to the question at the top of the item, what happens then when all those people are gone? Will the collective folk memory of those people go with them? Will people have a soundtrack to their lives? Because, you know, especially at Christmas, if you go into a supermarket, you're always going to hear certain songs. People have a soundtrack to their lives, but no sense of where it comes from.
I think the sense of where it comes from will always be there. I think a more interesting question, or another question really, is whether the generation of performers who are coming up now, the generation of artists who are coming up now, and you know, let's make no mistake, they're very talented and very gifted artists, but whether they will develop in the way that the previous generation of artists did.
Right.
And if you look, take the Beatles, it's an exceptional case to take, but if you look at the progress, the musical progress that the Beatles made between 1962, Please Please Me, and 1967, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, I mean, it's a quantum leap in quality, imagination, performance. And in a sense, the times that they were working in, the particular climate that they were working in, encourage them to do that, allow them to do that. And I don't know whether Tom O'Dell will make the same kind of leap between now and 5 years' time. Maybe he will. Maybe I'll be proved wrong. But I don't know whether the times kind of allow that now.
James. I think I can answer that question for you. I think it would be impossible for Tom O'Dell to do it simply because it already has been done. Mm. But that doesn't mean that the experience of a kid today is any more disappointing than it would have been in the 60s glory days.
No, absolutely not. And we have to remember that, you know, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, James Brown, Otis Redding, people I particularly loved, they were singing to me as the person I was at that time. And today's generation of artists are singing to their generation, and that's how it should be.
Yes, that's true. One Direction are singing to me. That's very true. Mick Brown and James Dellingpole, thank you both very much. For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.